This episode of Bend the Knee is brought to you by our bannermen, Lord Jason of House Ross, Lady Amanda of House Richardson, Lord Adam the Young Bull of House Parker, Sir Peter of House Whittingham, Sandy the Dragon, Blood of Queen Daenerys, and Lady of Jameson, Lord Brett of House Fry, Sir David of House Fraser, Lord Nelson of the Long Isle, Sir Joshua of House Ross, Lady Liz of House Hendricks, Sir Matthew of House Perry.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Bud Knight.
And I am Sir Ezra, the Watchful. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Theon 2 of A Clash of Kings, and in our Maester's study, we will be discussing Moat Cailin.
Yeah, as you know, today's episode is, you know, I think we joke around, right? Because the one time we did... The World of Ice and Fire, we got to the Ironborn and we were like, it's not very cool. And then we started getting into it. We're like, all right, this is pretty cool. And I think ever since then, people are just like, these guys don't even like, you know, the Ironborn. But,
you know,
we don't.
Are they wrong? No, gosh. No, I thought you were gonna say like we got to that point in Ice and Fire and we said, skip it. I actually think we were joking before we recorded that we said, let's just skip it.
Let's just skip it.
Right? I'm totally kidding, but
do we even need to do this chapter? No, yes, this is a good chapter. And you know, this is gonna be tough. For me, because when I think of the characters, I think of their faces and I think of these things. And so if you hear me say Yara today, describing this character, I actually mean Asha, because that's what it is in the book. Although her name is Yara in the show, I actually think Yara is a better name anyway. But that's just me. But that it is the same character.
Let's say it. Now you got me mixed up here. So let's say it three times. So we got Asha, Asha, Asha. Got it. Okay.
Yes. Cool.
All right. No, I know what you mean. I know it's yeah. If we slip up, it's fine. I mean, I go back and forth between Brienne and Brienne. So whatever. I just do that to mess with people, by the way. So if you listen to the audiobook, you'll know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I get you. Yeah. Asha Greyjoy, going to be a big focus for us today. So, yeah. Yep, we'll get into that. But before we do, how's it going, man? How you been?
Hey, man, it's good. Another week here. Episode 99. That is crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
You know? Yeah. That means episode 100 of the reread is going to be a Tyrion chapter, which is great. I think Tyrion's the perfect character to have be our centennial.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. It is crazy. We just had on one of our other podcasts, Hyperspace Hangout, we were talking about like an anniversary, and so it's weird we're kind of coming up on maybe, you know, like a, you know, pretty cool moment for this podcast too. It's just great. I know there's a lot of craziness going on out there, and we hope everyone's doing well. We're recording this on Memorial Day, so happy Memorial Day to you folks here in the US. And it's just great. It's summer's about to hit. It's a nice day out here for me. So when we're done, I'm gonna go out and kind of get some yard work done. But,
Hey, good. States are starting to open back up, which is pretty cool. Hope everyone stays, safe, wear your mask, take your, hand sanitizer with you. Mm-hmm. But that is at least some good news, right? That these states are kind of opening back up. So maybe, you know, here in the next couple of months, we can all return to the jobs we all lost, right? Like myself. So there's that. But All right. Well, let's dive in here, man, because we got a lot to discuss today. So I thought we'd start the show talking a little bit about the HBO prequel, right? Because we had a Raven asking us to talk about Daemon Targaryen. And the last time I checked about the prequel, everyone was saying it's going to be Dance of the Dragons. Well, now some people are saying it might be some Aegon's Conquest stuff, too. So who really knows? It's still way too early to find out. But HBO Max, the new streaming service, does come out this week, so it's possible you may get some news because everyone's going to be searching HBO Max, and then they're going to be saying, what's all on this thing? What all content can I watch? You know, people are going to be exploring all of that stuff. And so, you know, it's possible you may get, like, you know, a piece or two of information about that show because... we did just get announced, not that it has anything to do with Game of Thrones, but it does have to do with HBO Max, that DC Comics is finally releasing the long-awaited Zack Snyder cut of Justice League. And that said, it's not even going to come out until 2021, right? And they're spending $20 million to re-edit that movie.
Yeah.
I'm all for, because for those of you guys who don't know anything about Justice League or Batman or Superman, or, you know, you're not... weren't fans of the original movie, there is like an another version of the movie that's like entirely different. It's way darker because there was like some stuff, I think his like son or something committed suicide, right? It's like son died, I think, right? Or something during the production of that movie. So he had to step out and then another director came in whose name I'm blanking on, but he directed Firefly and Avengers and came in, redid the movie, and so, but anyway, so we're getting that, which is cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
I'm super looking forward to that, but that's something that's not coming out until way later, right? 2021, and they're already talking about it for HBO Max, so I think it's possible we may get some news about the Game of Thrones prequel soon, because, you know, the new streaming service is coming out. Everyone's going to be like, what's on this thing? What's going to be coming out? And everyone's going to be like, oh, wait, wow, there's a Game of Thrones prequel coming, because up till now it's just been like announced that it's happening, but they haven't like had any real reason to share any details. Well, now they might have some reason to share some details, because hey, we want everybody to jump on board with this streaming service.
Yeah, for sure. You would turn to the showrunner and say, hey, is there anything I can kind of say, or, you know, whatever, what piece of information can I give to people out there when we, you know, launch this or make an announcement. You want what people are searching, you know, if somebody's just searches Game of Thrones, and then you want HBO wants sort of their new streaming service to come up, you know, so that's just another way to put that out there and search and get more people over to kind of hear the news about this, right? This new thing that they're doing. So that would be cool for us. That would be really neat if they drop some nugget in that regard. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to mention too. So You brought up the our YouTube video and us doing some of those, yes. Like Daemon Targaryen. We're going to look at Rhaenyra Targaryen. We're going to go and kind of look at the Dance of Dragons. And we might have to go back. We might have to even go back to Aegon's Conquest and really talk about Aegon, you know, just because I don't really know either what the show is supposed to focus around, or if that's been revealed or anything. I think they just keep saying fire and blood. And well, fire and blood would be... there's a lot. There's a lot there. So, you know, that's going to be interesting if people have more details on that, or there's more info out there on maybe what the show is going to look at, or what part of Fire and Blood it's going to look at. That would be kind of cool. I'm either way, I'm excited. You know, either way, if they want to go back and do Aegon's Conquest and go nuts, I'm all for it, man. I think it'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it just seems like the Dance of Dragons is the place you go, because a lot of the other stuff is so vague. I mean, gosh, if it's all of fire and blood, that's going to be like, how are you going to do that? I mean, there's going to be a lot of time jumping. I mean,
well,
you
know, see,
you could do Aegon's Conquest to Maegor the Cruel, but then it's like, hey, you get to some weird spots where you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Kind of make it up. I mean, it's really like there's, I mean, we don't really, you can show us those major battles, or maybe they're going to incorporate that as sort of like a prologue or something, and they're going to show us sort of Aegon conquered, and here's where we are, flash forward past the old king, you know, right into Viserys the First, and here we go with the, you know, the greens and the blacks or something. I really just don't know how they're going to navigate that, because you could do Aegon's Conquest and just make it be this really you know, awesome thing, but you'd have to add to it. I mean, you can't just go, I mean, again, Fire and Blood is just the bare bones. It's just, even though it's a little bit more fleshed out than A World of Ice and Fire, like, it's open for a showrunner and for writers to go in there and make a cool story. So right. there's ways you can do it. It's just, if they did that, that's a whole season, Aegon's Conquest. I think you would, you know, unless you're going to do, I don't know why you would do one episode there and then do a time jump right. or something. You know what I mean? Like, you want to get invested in these characters and really start to kind of like and care about them. And where you get that depth and you get that complexity is in A Dance of Dragons. So that's, I think, where I was leaning towards. I thought that's where they were going to go. But I'm open for, if you want to introduce me to Visenya and Rhaenys and Aegon, I'm all for that. And talk about the complexities there and, you know, Aegon's sons and what happens with Maegor. I mean, there is a lot there too. You know, you could do that for the TV show. So,
yeah. Anyway. So we'll see. Yeah. But I mean, that streaming service launches this week. So, you know, it's possible. Sooner or later we'll get some news on it. But I think it's more likely we hear more about this prequel show than we hear about Winter. I mean, I think first. So So there's that. We should have a poll. What will we hear about first, the prequel or Winds of Winter?
Right. Right. Can I just say too, as we move out of sort of the news here, you always do this. You always type in like Game of Thrones news or Winds of Winter news or whatever, and you go look at, you know, Gurr's blog. I decided to go in here and I just typed in Game of Thrones news on Google, wanted to see what would come up here, and you know, it's like insider 2 days ago, why the ending of Game of Thrones may not have aligned with the books. I could, you know, they're not finished. You know, like,
well, exactly.
I mean, like, so it's just kind of funny. I'm just sitting here going like, why aren't we writing these articles? No. And then another one, they're talking about fans spotting an error between Daenerys and Khal Drogo's wedding. And then, the big one here, Screen Rant, Game of Thrones, 10 things, we've never understood about Daenerys Targaryen, you know, and this is all kind of coming up because 1 year ago, around this time, we had season 8, you know, and all this controversy and everyone talking about like what was happening with season 8 and why things aren't being answered or why things are going the way they're going. And we had so many questions and speculation, and it was a crazy time. And so now people are writing, you know, 1 year ago, and they're kind of doing these wrap ups and talking about, you know, the impact that show had just over a year ago. So,
yeah, it is crazy to think. Yeah, it was 1 year ago. People have definitely been sharing like what was going on and all of that stuff. Like a year ago, thinking about it, it's crazy to think, you know, like, hey, we were watching the end. I mean, I remember, gosh, sitting there, especially like episode 3, just like, oh my God, watching it, being like, this is crazy. Like having no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah. Can I tell you too, one of my favorite memories, and I know I've mentioned this probably about 6 months ago or maybe, but when I was at Star Wars Celebration, I remember I'm there. It was a Sunday, wasn't it? Yeah. And it was like, I had to, well, when was that? Anyways, yeah, because I think we stayed for Monday. But I was in a hotel in some back, like, conference room that had been closed. I was going around a hotel looking for an unlocked door, trying to find a conference room to get into so I would not be disturbed and I could just sort of talk to Sir Matt about the, you know, the show. And I was in Chicago at Star Wars Celebration, and I will never forget just kind of walking around and pacing. And if you go back and listen to that episode, there are people walking past me, you know, and they hear me say Game of Thrones, they give me like thumbs up, and they're walking past, and I'm, you know, doing the best I can to kind of talk about it. So it was a crazy time. It was cool. It was really cool. And again, we got a lot more listeners and people who were interested in the books and decided to kind of pick up A Song of Ice and Fire and just roll with it. So it's been great.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So, all right, as well, let's dive on into the Maester's study today. I believe we're talking a little bit about Moat Cailin.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to mention, I think next week I'm going to have Lady Raj, Mistress of Horus, back on. Like I said, once a month I'm going to try to bring my squire on and do a Maester study. So this is sort of a shout out to her, and maybe next week we can kind of get together and figure out what that next study is going to be for Tyrion's chapter next week, episode 100. But this week, yeah, we're talking about Moat Cailin. We always try to find something in the chapter, something that's referenced in the chapter, and pull that out and kind of expand it a little bit. And we've mentioned Moat Cailin before, but I wanted to bring this up because it's going to be important to the Theon chapters moving forward. It really is. It's this ancient stronghold of the First Men, and it's right there. If you pull up a map, you'll see that it is north of Greywater Watch. So we're talking about this neck, this region, this access point up into the north. So it's basically the roads. And if you look at the swamp area there around the neck and around Greywater Watch, which, by the way, I just had a flashback to us covering A World of Ice and Fire and talking about the great flooding and how possibly the children tried to like separate the north from the south right there, right? Just like they did with the breaking of the Arm of Dorne. Somehow that just hit me because you look at all the water there and you look at how the water is sort of, this is almost a point where Westeros would be cut in half. I mean, it would be like there's swamp region. It's very marshy and stuff like that. And then just north of that, once you get your footing through Greywater Watch, you run into Moat Cailin. And it's this stronghold that essentially you won't get to the north. You're going to have to sail around. You're going to have to take some ships and land on the shores and kind of invade that way versus just marching an army straight through the south. And that's a big deal because even during this time, it's easier to take a force on land. You know, men marching or men on horses, you have a smaller force when you decide to take them on ships. You risk running into storms and losing people along the way. And then once you land, like, you know, you have to march inland and they're already on land and already have the high ground and all this kind of stuff. So it's very important if you're going to march north and you're going to try to take the north that you go through Moat Cailin. It's in a real strategic point, I guess, if you will. So yeah, it was once a great stronghold with 20 towers, a wooden keep and a great sort of curtain wall, this high wall it's almost as high as like what you would see at Winterfell. And it's made of this black basalt kind of layer. Let's see, there's three. So that's interesting. So of the 20 towers, we have three towers that remain. They're covered with green moss and it's definitely old. It's an ancient tower and it's still very important, even though it's lost a lot of its other, you know, features and stuff, and it's lost these you know, towers. It's still kind of very important to hold. So let's see. And I don't want to go, we could go into the history of it, I guess, a little bit. As I said, you know, it's this spot where it was raised by the First Men, and it's claimed that Moat Cailin has defended against southern invasion for 10,000 years. And again, I'm glad that I read that because going back a couple weeks, I was talking about how we hear about Azor Ahai, the great hero. We hear about all these ancient heroes, this long night. And I think the story is distorted. I mean, over 10,000 years, a lot of stuff has to get changed and distorted and lost. And, you know, I think that's just interesting to keep in mind. So this is, again, 10,000 years ago, perhaps Moat Cailin has been around defending from a southern invasion. And of the 20 towers, we have three left. So according to myth, the Green Seers of the Children of the Forest worked dark magic at Moat Cailin. From the Children's Tower, they are said to have used the Hammer of the Waters. So that's what I was talking about, the Hammer of the Waters. And they were trying to bring that down on the neck. So just south of Moat Cailin, they were trying to bring large amounts of water and break Westeros into two continents. And again, Matt, this is interesting, right? That you have Greywater Watch right there in the midst of that, which is this mysterious disappearing, you know, keep just south of Moat Cailin where Hallen Reed is in the Krenugmeng. And they look like children, maybe a crossbreed between First Men and children, perhaps.
Right, so, and nobody knows who they are or where they're from. Yeah, right. It is. You know, I also think, you know, I pulled up, I have an image of it pulled up from the show because I was trying to remember where exactly did we run into Moat Cailin at the show, and it's, you know, it's Ramsay takes it, right? When he sends Theon in, you know, Reek in, and he has to go in and pretend that he's Theon Greyjoy to convince them to surrender, and then they do, and then Ramsay comes in and kills them all.
Yeah.
But you know, the show, actually, you look at the like a picture of it here, I think they do a really good job, right? It's this kind of big beat up fortress, and it's in like the middle of this enormous swamp, right? And there's just like one road that goes through it. I mean, you can just see how they talk about how difficult it would be to take. I mean, it's like, how would you ever take this, right? Except for the fact that just nobody's usually in it, right? I mean, those Ironborn would have been able to, had Theon not shown up, right? There's no way that they would be able to take it by force.
Oh, sure. And that's the thing is that, you know, at times it's garrisoned really well. I think it's House Glover is there, and that's predominantly like they're kind of in charge of keeping that and keeping it garrisoned and things. But when these armies have marched south, yeah, like it's open. And that's the thing that we're going to get to in this chapter is that Asha is sent to take it, essentially.
Right.
And we're going to go take Moat Cailin because it's relatively undefended, and Theon's upset that he's not the one going to go take it. But yeah, it's not, unless there's no one there, then sure, you can walk right up and take it. But even with a few men, you know, it's difficult to take. It's still, you know, you have to time it just right when it's not garrisoned or what have you. Yeah. So, because one of the things, going back to the history, is when the Andals invaded and they kind of landed over in the Vale region and they spread across and intermarried and all that kind of stuff, before they did all that intermarriage, they were warring against the First Men. And once they've basically controlled the South, one of the last things that they do, the last region that they're trying to take is the North. And they sent army after army up there in Moat Cailin over the years, along with the marshy terrain around there, around Greywater Watch, slowed their forces. And they, you know, even though they have better weaponry and whatever, they could not, you know, get beyond Moat Cailin. So it's great, you know, point of defense for the North.
Yeah. I mean, I just think back to, right, you know, some of that, probably one of the most epic, Ned Stark moments, right? When he's talking to Catelyn, right? And he's talking about dispatch, you know, these guys these guys here. He's like, take them to Moat Cailin. You won't be able to get through. And it's like, yeah, it's sweet.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I know. That's, yeah. Call the banners. Yeah. Get everybody rallied up. Garrison the old forts and get everything ready to go. And that's the thing. Like, it had never been taken from the South. It was vulnerable to the North and to the East, is something that the wiki says. And there were multiple, during the time when you had many kings, you had the Kings of Winter, and you had, you had multiple, every little sort of region and area had a king, but they would ally together and send forces there to kind of protect or meet Southern invasions at Moat Cailin. So, but yeah, you're right. That was one of those epic moments where it's like, that's a really important point. What is happening in this chapter is, the Greyjoys are hoping that Robb will be kind of stuck at River Run, won't be able to fall back and to retreat north, because they will have Moat Cailin held against him. And then again, once they are holding Moat Cailin, they can work behind it. They can go to White Harbor. They can go to Torrhen Square, Winterfell, all these different, the Dread Fort, and they're hoping to go there and basically get resources and collect, you know, whatever, whether it's treasure, money. They're going to do all sorts of stuff up there. Now, they even say, like at Winterfell, sure, you can kind of hold out for a while, but we're going to eventually, get into Winterfell as well. And if you look at where Pike is, and you look at where Riverrun is, and you think, well, could Robb sail around, or could he get back up? No, he'd have to go sort of past the Iron Islands, and that's not good. They're known for being masters of the sea. Like, they're gonna that's their turf, really. That's gonna be difficult. So they really would have them in this spot, and we'll talk about it later. But I think a lot of this is, if you can't get to the Baratheons and you can't strike there, and you're really not interested in striking at Lannisport, well, then you know, the Starks were a part of that group, that force that put down the Greyjoy Rebellion,
right,
and took Theon as a prisoner or ward or whatever. So that's definitely still got them pissed off, and they're going to do something about it. So
okay,
that's pretty much it, though. Yeah, Moat Cailin, right. Keep it in mind, and we'll talk more about who has it, who's controlling it, and what that means, and how it switches hands and how it switches power, because it does throughout the series.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Ez, let's dive into the reread here. This week we were in Theon 2. Been a little bit since we were with Theon. Last week we were with Jon, right, on our way when we went to Craster's Keep, right? And we learned that Mance Rayder's gathering people at the Frostfangs, and also that Craster does some pretty interesting things with his sons. So last time we were with Theon, after an absence of 10 years, Theon Greyjoy arrives back home on the Island Pike aboard the Meriam. He docks at Lordsport and is disappointed to discover that his father, Lord Balon Greyjoy, or as George R. R. Martin pronounces it, Balon Greyjoy, has sent only Theon's uncle Arian, a priest of the Drowned God, to escort him to Balon's castle. At Pike, Theon is greeted coldly by his father, after which he presents Balon with Robb Stark's letter. Balon rejects the proposed alliance with Robb, instead insisting that he will pay the iron price and carve out a kingdom of his own. This week, Theon 2, Theon Greyjoy meets an ironborn woman calling herself Escrid, while admiring his new longship, immediately taken by her. Theon responds to her flirtations, eventually offering her a ride to his father's castle. They continue to flirt en route to Pike, but upon their arrival, Theon discovers that Escrid is actually his older sister, Asha, or Yara for you show-only people. At the feast held by Lord Balon Greyjoy that evening, Asha sits in a seat to Balon's right, a place of high honor. Theon and Asha later join their father and two uncles, Victorian and Arian, in Balon's Solar, where Balon reveals his plans. Theon is furious to discover that he has been given the least important mission. Yeah, so, you know, as some pretty... So there's definitely some things here, you know, as we kind of going back through this, we've kind of been discussing differences between the show and the books, right? And one of the biggest differences is the merging of this character, Victorian Greyjoy, with another character, Euron Greyjoy, right? Victorian Greyjoy, not in the show, and really... I think the show does kind of a good job of kind of blending the two into the Euron we see in the show. Like, show Euron it's kind of different. I'd say he's pretty different than book Euron, right? You know, the show Euron encompasses a lot of this stuff we hear about Victorian sailing around, doing all of these things, you know, having been away for a really long time. Whereas a lot of that's actually Victorian, right? He's kind of that more like pirate side. Euron has like some more mysticism to him, right, in the books, and like he's got his own kind of like god and his own banner and all of this other stuff. And so that's kind of an immediate kind of wow, okay, like jump if you were only a book, if you were only a show watcher.
Yeah, it is different. Learning about Victarion and Euron is interesting. So yeah, slightly different. It's weird too. Like in the book at first, Asha kind of seems to downplay Victarion, but he's a big deal. It's just because we're talking among Greyjoys. I think to the rest of the people there at the Iron Islands, he's, you know, second in command. I mean, he's a big deal underneath his brother Balon. But yeah, when Euron comes back, it's a whole different ballgame. It's definitely different and something that... shakes things up. So so that's interesting. And there's another character in this that's really interesting, and this is where I love the books again over the show. I always will, just because I love the minor characters. You have, well, we get all these different houses, right? You get houses like House Stonehouse. You have House Drum, and this guy Dagmar Cleftjaw, right, who was sent to go get those houses. So he's actually a really cool character, and we'll talk more about him later on. I actually debated whether or not to talk about that character in our Maester study, but I think next time we come to Theon, I think I'll talk about him because he's fascinating. So, yeah, it's the Greyjoys have never been my strong suit, and I never have given them a whole lot of thought. Where I really started to like them is when Euron shows up later. So that's when I thought they were interesting. I'm like, holy crap, what is this? Who is this guy, and what is all this craziness going on? And that's when I backtracked, and I remember trying to learn more, and like, who's related to who, all that kind of stuff. But I remember on my initial read going like, who cares about the Greyjoys? But then it was him that actually brought me back into this. Because I'll be honest, this chapter, it's one of those, you know, Theon, it's frustrating. Because there's so many times where I'm saying to Theon, doggone it, like, what if you would have acted this way? You know, like, would your father have treated you differently? Maybe there's some mistrust, but like, it's because of his, you know, who he is. And because he has this... this manner about him that causes us to not like him. But I also think it's sort of a defense mechanism because he's been up with the Starks this whole time and he has to believe that he's a big deal and you know, they're making him feel like they're a part of, like he's a part of the Starks. And then knowing what I know in the show, I'm actually really hoping that his arc ends up being a lot like it does in the show, just because I'm like, there is redemption, because right now I don't like Theon. You know, in this series, it's just like, geez, man, like he's making so many mistakes here and he looks like a fool. And that's the point. That's the point that George is trying to, we have these ups and these downs. And so when you come to these chapters, you're just like, oh, it's just awkward. And you're just sort of like, you want him to be better. But at the same time, you're sort of like, well, I kind of get it. You know, this sucks. This is one of those things where it's a turn. Like, we thought that, because we love Rob, you know, as you're reading along, you're like, all right, I really like Rob Stark, and he's going to send his boy Theon. They're going to get help, and this is going to be a screw you to the Lannisters. Like, watch this. We're going to get the Greyjoys are going to help out. Oh, no, Theon goes, and his father has different plans. And then we're just like, seriously? You know, like, that just sort of is the frustration, but...
Right. Yeah. Anyway. It's just, yeah, it's interesting to think because Theon's put in a really tough position here. I mean,
I know.
I think and that's why Catelyn says, you know, it's interesting the way it's told to us, right? Because the way it's told to us is that you shouldn't trust Balon Greyjoy. And then, you know, and she also doesn't want to send, you know, she doesn't want to send Theon, in a way trusting Theon. But I think the real kind of mistake isn't necessarily the real mistake is thinking that Balon Greyjoy would actually go along with it, right? I mean, because he just what like I don't know what, is there anything ever that we would believe that would lead you to believe that he would join? Yeah, I mean, When I think about, like, you know, sending, I almost feel like you would have been better sending somebody other than Theon, right? Because it's like, well, I'm his son. It's like, yeah, but you're
that was the bargaining chip that you were holding. You were still holding his son, and you could have used him against his father.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you send somebody else to just be like, hey, here's what we want to do, then his father has to make a demand to you. You know, that goes back Once you give him back Theon, he doesn't even, you know, trust Theon, right? I mean, so it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And really, I think the thing is, too, you know, even if they would have sent somebody else, it seems like Balon saw an opportunity and had already put plans in motion. You know, as Theon is showing up, he sees that, oh, okay, some of these great ships are showing up and it looks like we're gathering our forces here. Maybe, you know, he did write on ahead and say that he was coming and they did know that he was going to be coming their way, but it's sort of like, when did they actually start all of this planning and conniving? Is it when they learned that he was on his way back, or were they already ready to make a strike at the Starks? I think it's a couple times where the Starks underestimate these people who have been scorned or who have been laughed at or who have been cast down in some way. So the Greyjoys and the Freys, you know, the Freys, we hear about all the mockery that goes on with them and in their relationship with Riverrun and everything. And it's just sort of like, that cannot be overlooked. That's that politics, that game that you have to remember, like, look, they're just putting on a good face for right now, but underneath that they're hurt and they're upset and they're ready to strike. They're a dangerous snake, and you know, again, it's going to take a long time for them to get over all of these other injuries that you've bore them. So,
yeah,
whether they're injuries to pride or actual, you know, a military strike or whatever, it's still that they feel like they've been wronged and they're whatever. So yeah, it's kind of tough. It's just frustrating, I guess, because you're like, yeah, why did he think? And that's the other thing that the Ironborn have is that people underestimate them. They're not even in the equation until they get down to River Run and they're in this position. Never did they think that they would strike north and that they would try to cut them off in their retreat. They just figured, well, no, we all hate the Lannisters, right? I mean, this is clearly you're going to see things from our point of view, so you're going to join us. And when you don't, it's sort of like, oh, how did we not calculate that? How did we not see
well,
that?
Well, you know, and I actually think, you know, Balon Greyjoy explains, you know, in the last chapter, right, that, well, I could go take, you know, like Casterly Rock, and stuff like that, but then, like, Tywin Lannister, like, we don't have the men to keep him, which is why he actually gets upset when he takes Winterfell, right? He's like, you know, we're not gonna be able to hold that and all this other stuff. But I don't know. Balon Greyjoy, I mean, you know, you think sometimes I'm critical of Renly thinking, you know, like, ah, geez, you know, like, you know, you're gonna try and make your own kingdom. What are you thinking, man? Yeah. Like, what are you doing? But Balon Greyjoy is like the real guy to be like, dude, what are you thinking? Like,
yeah, I know. Even it's in their culture. It's just,
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what's your goal? What's your game plan here, man? What's like your what's your end game? I guess take the north, right? Like that's what you think you're gonna be able to. Think you're gonna be able to do that, right? Like,
yeah, and it's like instead of helping somebody else gain a crown, I mean, he does exactly what he did in the first Greyjoy Rebellion, which is, well, though it was a little bit later. Like he kind of decides, you know what? No, I'm not going to. I think I should be king. And I think we're going to do our own thing. We're out here on our own. We're not going to pay taxes. We're not going to do whatever. We still hold to our own drowned God and all that kind of stuff. So it's more like, no, I am king. I'm proclaiming myself king and here it is. So deal with it. And if you're going to pick a time to do this, seems like a better time to do it than the first time. You know what I mean? Like that just seemed kind of really stupid. The first Greyjoy Rebellion just didn't seem like it ever had a chance. And this one does, because there's so much chaos and there's so many people proclaiming to be king, and you know, it's not like Robert Baratheon has like a long line or like he really was able to establish his rule. I mean, he did himself, but then through like an heir. That's the thing is the succession, to make sure that you're able to kind of secure your legacy, and that's what Robert could not do. So obviously, because he's got a bunch of bastards.
Right, you know? Right. So. Yeah. I think if you're Balon Greyjoy, like your best bet in this situation is one, wait for everyone to just kill it, because you're in Pike. I mean, you're over in the Iron Islands. You can just sit back and wait, right? For everyone to just sit back and wait, and you know nobody's gonna turn their attention on you, or you can join up with somebody, and do some serious damage. I mean, if I were Balon Greyjoy, I would have. I mean, even if your plan is then like, oh yeah, I'm gonna. I mean, you could deceive somebody later. It's not like on the Iron Islands they really care all about, you know, like laws and you know rules. It is kind of a little more like it is definitely a little more less honorable and stuff there, right? Like it's just the iron price and that's it. I mean, they only serve the drowned god, right? What's dead may never die, which comes up a lot in this chapter. I mean, I would almost call up Renly Baratheon, right? And say, hey, like, I'll join you. I mean, then, you know, you've really solidified that Western. If you're Renly Baratheon and Balon Greyjoy wants to join you, but he's, you know, I get freedom or whatever afterwards, you could even make an alliance that says, I get the North. And Renly may join you, may agree to, you know, not fight with the Starks at that point. Not, I mean, because he doesn't really have any reason to align with them at that point other than they hate the Lannisters. But if you get Balon Greyjoy, then you can squeeze Casterly Rock and there's nothing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that would take the Lannisters completely out.
Yeah. If you look at the history and you look at sort of how the Iron Islands and you remember the Riverlands, like before they were given over to House Tully and stuff. You had Heron, and you had like these different, like it seemed to stretch back over to the Iron Islands, and there was some kind of connection there. It just seems like
right.
They're more pirate. I mean, they're pirates. I mean, they're really they're just sort of attacking. They're striking. That like they'll strike the coastline, get what they can, leave. They're all about just themselves and gaining whatever they can, and they've never really been into alliances, and that's just not their way. It's not in their customs. And that's the thing that we're kind of understanding is that everything that Theon is pitching to them and talking about alliances and things that they can do or whatever, it goes against their customs and their ways. And that's what Asha keeps saying is you've lost your way. You've kind of forgotten, you know, what the Ironborn are and how different we are from the mainland. And I think I forget that sometimes too. It's sort of like they're very different. They don't want to be, they want to be their own thing. They want to be their own group, and they don't want to deal with anybody else. They actually want to take from everyone else, like not just like, oh, we're going to ally with right. the North and we're going to take from the South or vice versa. Uh-uh. They're just their own people. So I don't know. It's just sort of interesting when you think about it. And I think maybe if they did have, the reason I brought up that connection to the power struggle between the Iron Islands and the Riverlands is that like, if you actually did acquire some land and you had more resources and you did increase in wealth, like what do you do at that point? You know, like once they get what they get, I mean, like your forces don't get any bigger. It's not like they have like massive amounts of resources or whatever, but if they did get that, well then to keep what you have, like once you gain more, you have more to lose. So then you have to start kind of playing, I think, some of these games that these other great kingdoms or these other great regions are playing. Right now, they're just the Iron Islands, and they got nothing. So it's everything's on the table for them to gain. It's like the dog chasing a car. What would you do if you got it? I don't know what they're gonna do.
Right. It's like the opposite of Dorne. Right. Like Dorne can sit there and in a way they're kind of similar because you really have to make a concerned effort to go to Pyke and to the Iron Islands to try and take them on. Like if you wanted to claim it, it'd be so hard. I mean, it would be so incredibly difficult. Same thing with Dorne. Marching into Dorne is not an easy task at all because it's desert and there's mountains, to the north of it. I mean, you have to really, really think about trying to commit in order to do this. So they can just sit back and be like, oh, we're going to do whatever we want because we don't need to play your Game of Thrones. We can, but we don't need to. And so it's kind of the same thing with the Iron Islands where they can sit back and just say, hey, you guys do whatever you want. Good luck trying to, good luck trying to come attack us if you want to do anything. I mean, I know they they need to expand somehow, but yeah, eventually you would have to play the Game of Thrones. Yeah. I mean, that's the only way that's why I think, you look at look at Daenerys, right? Daenerys goes and does everything that is the opposite of the way you would normally play the Game of Thrones, right? Like she marries a Dothraki and all of this stuff. But even in the back of her mind, the entire time is I may have to marry, right? Cause once I get over there, I may have to marry. I may have to, I'm going to have to form alliances to take on these big armies and all of these things. And so she's even willing to go and do things a totally different way. In order to get what she wants, but the Greyjoys aren't, right? They just think that their way is, other than your impressive fleet, you don't have the manpower at all to control everything. And that's ultimately what ends up happening to them.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I know it's bizarre to kind of think about. So, I just noticed something. I want to make a quick correction here. So I think earlier, we're going to get to this, but the places in which they're attacking, so we were talking about, we brought up Moat Cailin. That is a place that we are going to attack, and that's sort of why I brought this up, but I had the two reversed. It's not Asha that's going there, it's Victarion that's going there to make that main thrust at Moat Cailin, and going up the Salt Spear in the Fever River. So just for clarity, earlier I was saying Asha, it's not, it's Victarion who's going there. So sorry, just read that and I was sort of like, oh shoot, because I was looking at a map We were pulling up these maps trying to look at, like, you know, Pike and its strategical location. And one of them, I was looking at Asha's journey, and it's like, oh, yeah, she goes to Deepwood Mott first up there. And we're going to talk about all of this later at the end of this chapter, because it is very important as to where they're going and what they're trying to do and the mess that they're trying to stir up in the north. So they, I mean, actually, they have a pretty good plan, but it's, and it would have been even better if Theon would have just thought things through, you know? So,
right. Yeah. So I just pulled up the map of the War of the Five Kings and looking at their thing. It is always kind of, I always think that the Iron Islands are a little bit further north, but they're really not, right? So they're just east. They're kind of, west of, kind of River Run, right? So like the Westeros kind of gets carved out right, and you get in the neck there. It really thins, then it opens back up. But off to that thin point is the Iron Islands. So really, I mean, they're like just north of Casterly Rock and west of River Run. So they have to make a pretty big, a pretty big effort to go north. I mean, they go way up to Deepwood Mott, mm-hmm. right? And then Theon's supposed to just go into there, and then he goes all the way to Winterfell, and then, going right in there through the rivers and everything to Mount Cailin.
Yeah, and that's where I had him kind of reverse. Yeah, but you're right. They're attacking at three different points there in the north. But, yeah, they're directly, as you say, just west of the Riverlands, and even the Twins are right there too, you know. So River Run is just a little, southeast of the Iron Islands. So,
which, you know, even looking at this, I mean, even looking at this map, like, ultimately, you know, you think Robb Stark and his men would have to come back, but Ramsay Snow is still sitting there. I don't see how they would ever stand any chance. I mean, especially like Deepwood Mott, I think Ramsay Snow could have taken that. Had Theon not taken Winterfell and just taken stuff more on the coast, how would you get the men up off the Iron Islands into the north to be able to try and hold any of these castles against some sort of bigger
army? Again, that's right. I don't think it's completely thought through. I think it's a collection of like trying to cause some chaos. I really think that main host that's going to Mount Cailin is going to just keep the majority of the fighting men, you know, from getting access back to the north to help free some of their people or even retakes any of the lands that were taken from them. You know, one of the problems, I guess it's Lady Hornwood, right? I mean, brings up, we talked about this issue of land and her losing her husband and a son and not having an heir. So what do you do? There's really the next biggest force, like the group of men who are kind of patrolling, is at Winterfell. That's where your next biggest garrison is. You've definitely got some folk we're building up ships over at White Harbor and stuff. But the idea is we're almost baiting Winterfell to come out. You know, like if they come out and want to fight, then it's fair game. But if they stay inside Winterfell, it's much harder to kind of get to. But so I don't know really what the, I think the goal would be just to kind of hurt them as much as possible and take as many, you know, resources as you can. And I don't know that you're planning on holding them long term. You know, I mean, unless they're really, I guess you're also banking that. Well, and this is what he says is that Tywin is and the Lannister forces from the south, they'd have them boxed in essentially, and maybe they, you know, then some of those regions that were that they are holding on the coastline up in the north would be theirs long term. So I take that back. I mean, I guess that is sort of the idea. Is that they'd be able to acquire more land or more resources, you know? I don't know. But it's just interesting. When you look at a map and you think, and I'd just love to talk to George in general, but I would love to talk to him about some of this, like the strategy, you know, and having a map and thinking about these different things. And, like, was he thinking through all of this and trying to see kind of strategically, you know, where to put people in a tough spot. And I think he is. Clearly he is. But it's just, it's well thought out. I mean, that's the thing. I guess I don't really think too much about, like, the planning of this story, but it's complex. You've got forces moving here, allies, alliances being made and things. And it's, it's a lot. So, all right. Any other thoughts, I guess, on that, just in general, you know, on the...
No, I'm just looking at the wiki, looking at some of his quotes and stuff like that. Right? You know, like, no man gives me a crown, right? I pay the iron price. You know, it's just some of the things that he, right? Some of the things he says. I mean, really, he wants to be like king of the Iron Islands, right? And I mean, you pretty much are. Again, I still think you could just make an alliance with somebody, but I mean, that's just kind of his character. He's stubborn and
yep,
right.
Yeah. So. It seems delusional, because I'll even go a step further here, and then we'll jump into some of this and just kind of summarize what happens with the sea bitch and so on.
Some big takeaways, right?
But right. What happens with Euron later on is there's this big proclamation that they're going to like take over all of Westeros, and you're like, what? You know, it's just crazy. But again, there's magical, mystical devices involved in that pitch. So it's just wild, but. So back at Lordsport, back at the docks, just to kind of summarize here in the beginning, this whole bit is just frustrating. And it's probably mostly frustrating for Theon, right? Who meets a ironborn woman calling herself Escrid. And it ends up being his sister. Gosh darn it.
Right.
He hasn't been home since, what, he was 9 when he was taken? 9?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we'll kind of do some big takeaways here. But yeah, so they're riding back and he's kind of, you know, doesn't really know it's his sister, just kind of thinking it's some just ironborn woman. They're kind of
he's attracted to her. She's, you know,
right. Yeah, he's kind of feeling her up. I mean, to put it you know, politely there. And she's teasing him, right? The whole way. Yeah, she's teasing him. She's totally having a lot of fun with this, right? But really what she's doing is she is
testing.
I was about to say feeling him out, but I think she really was where she's feeling him up. Yeah. So but you know, same thing. They're kind of trying to see, you know, like you know, who is he? Where does his alliance go? I mean, just kind of gathering some information on him, right? To try and see, you know, who he really is, because he came here under Robb Stark's banner.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I think one of the things, you know, if he's going to be a commander and a commander of men, one of the things that she kind of highlights, or a flaw that she points out in him, is that he doesn't know his men, and that his men wouldn't know him. No one knows who you are, and even when it comes to me, I'm your sister. And you don't even know who I am. Like, see, that's how far this goes. You don't know anyone here, and no one knows you. So much so that you're hitting on your sister, and you didn't even realize it. Had he have taken more time to get to know her and was more polite and didn't just push himself in on her or whatever, because she kind of goes with it, because she's very confident, she's very skilled, she is. Also, his older sister, and she's used to commanding troops. She's used to kind of she's used to a harder way of life than he is, you know. So he's nothing,
right?
I mean, to her, this is easy. She's just messing with him. But you know, I this is where I think, man, Theon, if you would have done a little bit more, just to kind of like got to know her and ask more questions, and you didn't just make all these advances, I think would have gotten some respect from her. And she would have been like, okay. And it makes their choice, it makes sort of the way they treat Theon more difficult. There might be more remorse in how they laugh at him and say various things. Because it is ultimately very sad that, like, Theon didn't choose this. He did not want to be taken to the north and be away from his mother and his father. And by the way, you figure out in this chapter that his mother is not with his father right now. And that's also something that needs to be kind of resolved, and we'll talk more about later on. But, you know, I mean, she's tore up that she lost her sons. They're gone. And that's it. And so this father, Balon, turns to his daughter, Asha, and she's it. I need you to step up. You're next in line. Like, you're it. And command forces, and she's built this reputation. She's a boss. As we say, she's no slouch. She is a boss, and she's well respected by these people. But we get a little bit more about their culture, just in that she says she's married to the shipwright and that she's with child, and it's all wordplay. It's all sort of just careful word choice. You know, really the child that she's nursing right now is right. It's like a dagger that's in between like her breasts and stuff, you know, that she pulls out later.
Right.
And yeah, so that's kind of interesting. She has her own ship, which is pretty cool. They talk about naming this new ship that Theon is looking at. Theon wants to call the ship a fair maiden, and you know, but later on, Eskrid says that she herself, referring to herself as a sea bitch, and he then declares that sea bitch is the name of his new ship, you know, which will be blessed by Aaron Greyjoy, his uncle, who's the priest of the drowned god, the next day. So this ship has been kind of made, and he was down there just admiring it, looking at it, and he's approached by his sister, who tests him the entire way back to what she knows will be a pretty big meeting tonight with the other leaders of the Ironborn. So,
right. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, so we get them. I mean, the majority of the chapter is them kind of riding around, you know, Pike, learning about stuff. You know, there's some, I think, some cool character development with Theon, because, you know, on one hand, you feel bad for Theon, right? Because, I mean, it's not his fault that he was, mm-hmm.
yeah,
you know, basically given away as a hostage, right? I mean, forcefully as a hostage, and then forced to live with the Starks his whole life. And then it's also not his fault that his dad isn't welcoming him back.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, and then he obviously, we'll get to it later, where he makes some mistakes and stuff like that. But then, you know, then maybe some redemption, some redemption down the line.
Let me jump in here real quick. So I think I said this last Theon chapter, and I didn't hear from anybody about this. So I'm going to say it again, okay? Who else wants to just say to Balon, like when he treats Theon this way, again, I know that Theon has his flaws and he's acting like he's a big high lordling and he's been sent by Robb, and that's got to feel good, because you know why that feels good? Here's why, Dad. Let me tell you. Because you lost, okay? You lost big time. The Greyjoys were squashed, and I was taken prisoner, and I didn't know my family, and I had to grow up with an adopted family, okay? Now, that's because you decided you wanted to be king. But yet, you're ticked that I came back, and I'm acting more like a Stark. Well, I mean, come on. You know, like, I was raised by the... What do you want me to do? And it's this crazy thing where he's starting to realize, and it's really interesting, actually, because Eddard Stark's a good guy. Even though they were on opposite sides there, Balon doesn't seem... He seems bitter. He seems spiteful. He seems really ambitious. You know, Eddard Stark is the guy who doesn't take the Iron Throne, right? He could have. And I think it's Jaime Lannister who says, all you have to do is sit there. Just sit there and you're it. You know, you're like, you're king. No, that's not what he wants. He wants to go back north. And it's like Balon is just the opposite of him. And maybe it's because of their, you can go back to, well, the Starks have, you know, Eddard is kind of more born into privilege than Balon and all that kind of stuff. We can go all sorts of different angles with this, but it's just frustrating to me that, like, that he treats his son this way when, you know, and Theon doesn't want to say those things to his father, but, like, I mean, at one point in the last chapter, last Theon chapter, he does give it back to him just a little bit, you know, and it's sort of like,
yes,
come on now, you know. Like, this is not, it's not what I wanted. So, anyways, I just can't emphasize that enough, because same thing for Asha. It's like, look, you got, I mean, a different experience than I did. You were older. I was much younger. You know, I had less time with all of my family than you did. It's just different. So, yeah. There we go.
Yeah. And there's one line I had highlighted here. This kind of goes back to what you were talking about with Asha talking about, you know, the men and all of this stuff here. He says, you know, says Lord Balon is but a father of a great man, right? You know, a modest lordling, right? Only a fool humbles himself when the world is so full of men eager to do that job for him.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, there is, you know, you do see some of Ned Stark in Theon, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you do get some of that, right? And then it's just tough because Theon's character, you know, how much of Theon do you actually see in the books, right? I mean, not really a lot, because then he turns into Reek, and you know, that's like a whole different.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, that's, he's like a totally different character. And then when we're at the end of where he is in the books right now, I think he's in a Winds of Winter chapter that we have, right? He may be put to death,
well,
right? So that's kind of...
Yeah, let's look at one more angle, too, on Theon. So, like, he's always looking for... He's looking for acceptance. He's looking for, he wants praise from Eddard Stark. He wants that from Robb. Like, he tries to become close with those... with those individuals. And when he saves Bran, remember when he shoots the wildling and Robb kind of gets right. all over him and gets upset that he did that. It's like, you know, he's doing that for a good reason, but it's because Bran's not his actual blood brother that he doesn't hesitate. I mean, and it's like maybe one of Bran's actual siblings would have hesitated and would not have taken that shot. But since he's, you know, he's also just, it's just odd. He's in a really odd spot and he's always trying to, you know, do more to show them that, like, look, I'm loyal to you. I'm trying to help out or whatever. And
well, he's definitely loyal to Ramsay Bolton.
Yeah, oh boy. Oh boy. I mean, I can't, those chapters are going to be just grueling. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
But
well, that's going to be a lot.
Now I'll say, I think I said this last time, an interesting character, and I want to do like a deeper dive on this character is Wex Pike, his squire. Who does not have a tongue, who cannot speak, and, you know, I think is privy to a lot of information that we're going to need later on. And so just pay attention to that character, because he kind of looks at one point in this chapter, like the squire could have maybe said something, you know, but doesn't. About his sister, you know. So anyway. So after they're talking for a bit, he does go back to the inn to try to find, Wex, and he realizes that it's packed. I mean, the inns are packed, and it's because everyone is gathering because Baelon is about to move his people. He's about to kind of orchestrate this, and they've gathered people from Old Pike down to Pike, and or Old Wick, and they're trying to get everyone kind of congregated there. They've got the ships there. And something is happening. If you had scouts out and you were like, if you had time to do that, which maybe in times of peace, like River Run, like the Tullys, Lannisters, and like they would have caught on to something's going on. But right now, it's wartime, so no one's really paying any attention over there. And the one person that you did send ends up, joining them. So anyways, they're getting everybody, you know, kind of together and. And this is it. Just more of that. When they go into that inn, you can really tell that it's bustling and there's a lot going on. So they then from there, I would say next point is that we actually we get ready for that dinner. You know, we're gonna go and before that, let's talk about the reveal. I guess that Asha is actually his sister. You know,
yeah, right. It's when he goes back to the into the inn, right? He's like, let me see here. A stableman came pounding up after the dogs. Take the horse, Theon commanded him, and get these damn dogs away. The lout paid him no mind. His face broke into a huge gaped tooth, smiled, and he said, "Lady Asha, you're back." Last night, she said, "I sailed from Great Wick with Lord Goodbrother and spent the night at the inn. My little brother was kind enough to let me ride with him from Lordsport." She kissed one of the dogs on the nose and grinned at Theon. All he could do was stand and gape at her. Asha... No, she cannot be Asha. He realized suddenly that there were two Ashas in his head. One was a little girl he had known. The other, more vaguely imagined, looked something like her mother. Neither looked a bit like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a shock. That's a shock. But, you saw along the way, too, like, everything that kind of frustrates him about the Iron Islands, the people, the food, the drink. Theon has just gotten used to a different way. He prefers wine over ale. The dog's kind of not really too friendly with them, but yet she is. The people, they give him gruffer, rougher looks and don't really accept him as well as they accept her. The food, eating the, you know, like fish and stuff doesn't really set well with him. And he's thinking about throwing up later. So yeah, everything, there's a lot of clues earlier that show us that, well, she's definitely truly an Ironborn and he doesn't fit in. And then now, that contrast is highlighted or emphasized even more going forward. Now we learn that she's his sister and she sits next to her father and continues to kind of mock him and play with him. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, and then it just goes into the whole idea, like, well, is it really his fault or whatever? But yeah, she is testing him, and you can tell there's definitely hints throughout. I mean, that it's his sister, right? So you know, he thinks like she must have enjoyed every moment of it, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like freaking out. He's like, you know, the way she was kind of grabbing me and all of this other stuff, you know, like. He says, I have no place here, he thought, and Asha is the reason. May the others take her.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Now, here's something. Remember we were talking about, like, sort of laws and customs and things like that. So we've already kind of said this, but, like, she's testing him to see, you know, and wondering why would men fight and die for him. And his thing, and this is, again, something he picked up in Westeros, is that I am their lawful prince. And that's not necessarily the case. That is not necessarily true. You know, and she says, by the laws of the Greenlands, you might be, but we make our own laws here, or have you forgotten? So, again, they got their own way of life here, and he has forgotten. He totally has. So, yeah, all right, so they roll in here,
yeah.
And this is where you get the feast, right? The feast was was meager enough thing. We've got fish stew, black bread, spiceless goat. Are these next up on mead, meat, and cheese? We're going to have some... Fish stew.
No, not yet. No.
The tastiest thing Theon found to eat was an onion pie. I'd like to try that. Let's do that sometime.
Actually, that is in the book, and it does look pretty good.
Yeah. Ale and wine continued to flow well after the last of the courses had been cleared away. So let's see. Lord Balon kind of rises from the sea stone chair. Have done with your drinks and come to my Solar, he commanded to his companions on the dais. We have plans to lay. So Theon's ready to get up and just, you know, rush in after his dad. And she's just like, hold on a second. Where are you rushing off to? And he's like, our Lord Father is waiting. Like, he's just obedient. Like, let's go. But again, it's just more toying. It's more, let me mess with my brother here and put him in his place. It just, it's frustrating. Sad to me. So Theon said, I mean, it. Now I say that it, like maybe Asha was tasked with this. By the way, that
she probably
yeah, was. Because she does love her brother. And again, I love that she's in command and she's in this position of power. And that and I really do think this whole custom, right? I mean, we know this, like this whole custom of like only men can, you know, ascend to the Iron Throne. And we were just talking in our YouTube video that was the whole. Jaehaerys the First, the Great Council of 101 AC, is whether or not the succession should pass to the male heir or should it go to females. It's still something that they're struggling with. But anyways, I think it's neat that like her father has trusted so much in her, and he does put she's a great commander, and she's one of the coolest. She's one of the best Ironborn. I mean, she is. She's like legit. We love her in the show and in the book. She's great. So a lot of me just thinks that this is all, they're all kind of testing Theon. They just don't know him yet, you know, and it's what it is. So they go back and forth about, you know, all the mishaps that took place on their journey in there and the touching and the feeling up and all that kind of stuff. So they go back and forth about that for a bit. And, this is once they finally, get into sort of like the war room, I guess, right? So they go in there and... Victarion was talking of tides and winds when Theon entered, but Lord Balon waved him silent. I have made my plans. It is time that you heard them. And he says, I have some suggestions. And when I require your counsel, I shall ask for it, his father said. We have had a bird from Old Wick. Dagmar is bringing the drums and stone houses. If the gods grant us good winds, we will sail when they arrive. Or you will. I mean for you to strike the first blow, Theon. You shall take 8 long ships north. So in a way, his father is trying to say that although you're only taking 8, you are making the first strike and you are leading, you know? But in a backwards...
Operation Human Sacrifice.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like that. There is some risk in it. I mean, it's like low risk, but yet like he is the first person to walk up to the bee's nest and poke it, right? And really, or the hornet's nest, whatever. And you know, it is put in danger. Everyone else is going to kind of come in later because they have longer journeys and they're given greater command. So it's like he's trying to I think he's trying to lessen the blow of, hey, you're only going to have 8 ships. Everyone else is going to have like 20 plus and command much larger forces. But don't worry, you're striking first. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of like he's trying to lessen that blow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because he's upset. He's furious that this is, you know, and he's also going with Dagmar too. Clefjaw is sort of a big deal. He's like a war hero. He's known well, and like he's a big deal. He essentially would have the command. I mean, the reason that these men are going to listen to Theon is because Clefjaw's there, and he has a reputation. So, you know, which is what Theon says. Like, really, this is not even my command at this point. So, which sucks.
Right. Okay, so after that, you know, this is when they're talking a little bit about, right, like, so, you know, so Theon's going to be doing, right, the first,
mm-hmm.
right,
yeah.
so the first batch there, and then they talk about where the other people are going to be going, right, you know, Victorian, right, the main thrust will fall to you, you know, when they've struck their blows, Winterfell must respond, right? Saltspear, the Fever River, we talked about this earlier. So Victorian is getting, like, I mean, he's getting the, you're going to be the main force here. Now, again, I just want to kind of talk about this because we don't see this idea in the show, right? It's just Theon and Asha, because Euron isn't even there yet, right? Euron doesn't show up in the show until much later, when Balon's dead and they have the council. But Victorian is that, like, he's like your main kind of battle commander, right? And so I just think it's important to think about that, him, Victorian, as this character that we're going to see more of in the book, because he becomes a huge deal mm-hmm. later. I mean, you want to talk about differences between show and the book and where Winds of Winter will go? Victorian Greyjoy is like an enormous player in the books later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for 100%. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a great setup to all these different, you know, characters and understanding sort of through Balon, like, what level of, like, the level of responsibility, like, the command that they're given kind of tells you what type of characters they are. And then, like you say, I mean, like relationship with their other brother later on. We talked about this earlier. Like, that's going to be a big deal. They all are, which is weird. Like, and where we experience or we interact with the Ironborn is it's not going to be as much. Well, we do come back to the Iron Island sometimes, but they really go off here on this little venture, and some come back and you know, some come back and then leave again and don't, you know, make it back. You know, they're still, their fates are up in the air. So they definitely have a role to play. I wanted to mention too. So when I was talking about Moat Cailin, this is interesting. I think because I'd heard this in the chapter when I was listening to it today, I was like, who garrisons Moat Cailin? And they were actually instructed. So the Tall Hearts and the Glovers were actually instructed to go there and garrison it. Because when you go to, let me go back here, Deepwood, right, is the seat of House Glover in the north. So there we go. So that's where Asha is headed. And that's sort of a big deal to go up there and take them on. And the fact that a lot of his forces are south leaves that pretty exposed. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. Yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, general, it's just Asha is given the second largest sort of command, and then Victorian is given the main host. So,
right. Okay. All right. Well, Ez, do we have a raven today? Yes, we do. This is the one from our good buddy, Sam the Hammer Man. We haven't heard from him in a while. He says, "It's good day, my lords. It's been a while. I hope you are both well and keeping tourney fit given the circumstances. A thought came to my mind during this week's episode that I was interested in getting your thoughts on. Given that Eddard, Catelyn, and various others of that generation developed such strong friendships by being fostered, don't you think it's odd that none of the Starks were fostered? Ned was fostered by Jon Arryn from the age of 8, and Brandon went to Borrowtown from a similarly young age. Yet at the start of the series, fostering doesn't seem to have been contemplated by either for either Rob or Bran. Imagine if Rob had been fostered by Renly or the Martells, or if Bran had gone to the Dondarrions or the Wents, how different the story would be. Robert's rebellion is a direct result of the loyalty established through fostering, and it's possible to speculate that the Starks would have been deposed without it. So it's not just an interesting what-if scenario, but a clear discrepancy in how we would expect Eddard to behave. Surely he's seen firsthand how fostering protected his family's legacy, and he would want to do the same. Why do you think none of the Stark children were fostered? Is it a way to protect Jon, or could it be a sign of Ned's regrets, some of the loyalties he held during the rebellion? What would have happened between the Starks if the Danes had not been for the Tullys and Baratheons, for instance? Is he giving his children the freedom he never had? Maybe it's another sign that Eddard is a more nuanced character than he often considers to be. Keep up the great work, and the additional content is really appreciated. During the lockdown, Sir Sam the Hammer. As I think I have actually a pretty logical reason for this. Let me just pull up a timeline here.
Yeah, first of all, this is a great Raven. It's a really good question though. I like it, Sir Sam. It's great.
So I think the easiest answer is because I believe they were at war when Rob would have been like 8 or 9, right? Because that's when Balon Greyjoy's rebellion is.
Yeah, well, and I was gonna say, like, I think some of it. So, I guess then. Yeah, I mean that is one reason. I was gonna say during the Targaryen reign, maybe why you saw more of that was because it was a time of peace. And if you go back to that Southern sort of ambition alliance or whatever it's called, right? That maybe the right. fostering took place more so because people were trying to build stronger ties, and they were trying to, you know, unite, I guess, maybe against the Targaryens or the Mad King or whatever. But it's a good thought, and it's interesting to think about how you make these alliances. It's something that Tyrion is trying to do with Myrcella, and Tommen was floated there as an option too. So you do understand that, like, hey, look, we're open, we're giving you one of our own because we're trying to make this alliance. But yeah, I think the Greyjoy rebel. When does that happen? How many years after?
So it's just about what I thought. It's 9 years after Robert's Rebellion, which is roughly also nine. It's 9 years before a Game of Thrones. It's 289 AC. I think Robert's Rebellion is 283. Yeah. So it's about 6 or 7 years. So Rob would have been about 9. I mean, maybe you were thinking about fostering him, and then you go fight this battle and all of this stuff, and so he maybe just misses out on it. And then the next closest person would be, I mean, Bran's only 7. So if you were only going to foster somebody when they were, you know, like, I don't know, 13, 14, after he fights his rebellion, it might just be. So I think maybe that was just, you know, logically, like, yeah, he just kind of missed out on it because we were busy with some other stuff.
Yeah, and I will say, too, one of the things that Sir Sam is hinting at is that the man, Robert Baratheon, when he comes north, Ned is a little unsure, right? I mean, he's not the same Robert, yeah. Right? He's not. He's not the same one that he knew back in the Vale and things like that. He's still there, but he's lost himself in wine and women and all sorts of stuff. So it's I there might have been some stuff, and maybe we just don't know this, you know, that went down with the Greyjoy Rebellion, and maybe he learned more about Robert, and maybe it is Jon. You know, maybe some of that is also that, like, he's trying to protect Jon in some way. You know, because he even
Ned is also a Ned. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Well, no, I was gonna say I know that typically the fostering takes place across, like, well, not typically. I don't know. I guess when we think about it, it's taking place from, like, the Stormlands up to the Vale. Like, both Robert and Eddard were fostered in different regions. You know, not just in the same. It's not like House Glover, like, takes Bran in for a little bit or whatever. You know, although they would. It seems to be you want to strengthen those ties by sending someone to another part of the Seven Kingdoms.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, the other, I think another important thing is, well, there's a couple points. One, Ned, after the Greyjoy Rebellion, Ned is then fostering someone there, Theon. He's also got John, who he's got to deal with, who's, you know, his bastard son. So he's, you know, they got him there as well. And then, you know, you look at how upset Lysa Arryn is, when, you know, they talk about Robert Arryn getting fostered by Tywin Lannister, right? She's, you know, like, abso-freaking-lutely not, is that happening? And so you think about the Tullys and family, right? Family is number one. So I think that Catelyn would not have let Rob be fostered. I think, you know, I want him here. Like, I think she would have put her foot down on it.
Yeah.
I think it was probably, I think, so for me, I think it's probably more circumstances, right? Because just right around the time he would be fostered, he just had a war breakout, or like a minor one, just a rebellion. And then also, then by that, after that, you have Theon there. So in a way, you're kind of fostering somebody else. And then also probably Catelyn and her strong ties with family, not wanting to put, I don't think she just would have wanted that to happen.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're probably right in a lot of that. And I would even add that I think with the decline, when you look at the fosterings that took place before, with Ed Arden and Robert Baratheon, like the decline of the Targaryens is very interesting. I think a lot of people knew that their power was declining and dragons were not there and things like that. So over time, it's sort of like, I think the Game of Thrones picks up a little bit. People are starting to think, like, how do I vie for power? How do we make alliances? And a very natural, easy way to do it is to say, I mean, it seems like a really nice and benevolent thing to just say we're going to foster our kids with one another. But these higher lords might be saying, like, this is going to benefit us in the long run because we foresee maybe a crack or a you know, kind of a chink in the Targaryen armor, and we're going to try to expose it. So.
Right. Okay. So, right. So Ned was fostered at the age of 8. Rob is born in 283. Greyjoy Rebellion happens in 289. So I'm just doing some math here. So 6, he would have been 6 when it happened. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, you know, that happens. So I think it's a combination probably of all of those things. So
yeah, sure. Because
then you have Theon there. So I think all of that kind of stuff. So if 8 is the age that you would foster somebody, well, Bran isn't even 8 by the time the series starts.
Yeah, and
so
maybe
I think the only person who would have been at the age to have been fostered would have been Rob, who I think misses out on it because of the Greyjoy Rebellion.
Well, and more so you're saying like after the Greyjoy Rebellion, right? Like why not afterwards? I think that's the question.
Right, because
mistrust and stuff.
Well, yeah, maybe that. But then also, well, I think his best chance would have been before because then everything would have been kind of normal. But then you have Theon there. And so in a way, you're fostering Theon, right? Because he's your ward. And so then Rob, they have somebody else now from another culture, you know, to kind of help you grow and expand. They're roughly the same age. So yeah. I think, you know, would you want to send Rob off when you have Theon, right? You're kind of wanting to, Ned's the kind of person where I want to raise, you know, I'll raise Theon the best I can as well. And so I don't know that I'd want to send off my firstborn son for that. And also, you know, I guess Brandon was sent off and he was their firstborn son. So I was kind of thinking about that, but you know, you have Benjen as well. So you had 3 sons. So, I mean, I think it was a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's just like a big combination of all those factors.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to think about though, you know, cause that is, it's a tactic that is used by these various lords to kind of make alliances and to shore up, power and make sure that you're protected. So it's just to foster and so you're fostering and then marriage alliances. So, really cool. And actually, that's a plug for the Patreon series, the Tourney at Harrenhal 4-part series. You want to look at more of what was maybe going on with Hoster Tully and John Arryn and the Starks and the Baratheons and what were they trying to accomplish there. So,
Yeah, I'm trying to look and see. So when Brandon gets sent off, you know, how old would Benjen have been, right? So because Benjen, I don't think was, because you want to have you'd probably want to have a Stark in Winterfell.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, always gonna have one. Yep.
So yep. Anyway, great Raven there, Sir Sam the Hammer. We appreciate that. Yeah. So kind of interesting. I love these kind of. Well, I don't know. Let's dive in. You know, questions that it's like even something like that where it's like
that was a good one. I like that. Well,
I don't know. Let's go look at this logically and kind of do some math and see what's going on. And yeah, it's great. Yeah. So, all right, guys. Well, we want to thank you guys for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing Chapter 25, Tyrion 6 of A Clash of Kings.
If you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com.
We will see you in a week. And remember that winter is coming.